Welcome back to Taking It Down. This is Ted Leahy, and I'm here with Pam, and we are ready for our Blue Shark Optics Guest of the Week. Tonight, our Blue Shark Optics Guest of the Week is the 25-year-old reigning main event World Series champion, winning two bracelets last year in the 43rd annual World Series. American-born and now residing in Canada is none other than Greg Merson. Thanks for joining us, Pam. Thank you for joining Pam and I, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolutely. Always good to have a big champion on the show, and sorry you didn't do it back-to-back, but it was a good effort. I know you had fun with your buddy that you run so good against, Wilfred.
Yeah,
get him 2 years in a row.
Yeah, it was pretty sick. I don't know how he shook my hand afterwards, but
some people just run good.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
I know we all have our nemesises, and I'm sure you're probably at the top of his list for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, first question is, you know, in general, where did you get your start in poker? How did you get introduced to the game?
I played with my brother's friend for the first time when I was 16, I think, and I lost $10, and it was just like the sickest adrenaline rush of my life. And then from there, I just started playing with friends, and I actually had this black box that I would keep my poker money in my bedroom when I was 16, and I started with like $20, and then after my senior year of high school, I had like $500, and then I never touched it or like spent it on anything. It was just for poker. And then I put $100 on party poker, and then I guess like the rest is kind of history after that.
Wow! So you stash all your winnings in a black box and never touch it. That takes a for a kid.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
I
mean,
bankroll management.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's pretty impressive for a kid, especially a boy in high school. Wow. So is that when you decided that you wanted to become a poker player full-time? Is when you, after you, at 16, you get the taste of it and the adrenaline rush, and then you put money on party poker, and you said it was history from then on. So is that how you decided you wanted to play poker full-time, or what made you decide
that? It was definitely a lot of ups and downs. I mean, I was playing nonstop my freshman year of college. I went to college at 17. Like, I didn't turn 18 until finals week of my freshman year. So I was playing all freshman year, and that's when my drug addiction was really peaking the first time around. And I was paying for my drug habit through poker money, so I was never able to build up more than like $2,000 or $3,000 total, because I had a drug habit of like hundreds of dollars a week. And then eventually I had about $10,000 to my name starting my third semester, and I ended up dropping out that semester to play full time, thinking that $10,000 was enough, because you know everything when you're 18, obviously. And then my dad told me I was an idiot, which I was at the time, so I wasn't ready at all, and I wasn't good enough or in the right state of mind. And after about 6 weeks, I lost half of that money and decided I would go back to a community college instead of University of Maryland, and just like kind of buy time. I mean, I knew that I was going back to school just to like please them, but I wasn't done like trying to get better at poker, and then eventually do it again. And I lasted a semester and a half in community college and dropped out again. But the second time I dropped out, I actually had negative $1,000 to my name. But I was like 2 months sober, so I was just really, really locked in on like my goals, and just knew that nothing was going to stop me, and I just was going to give it all I had. And you know, the worst thing that happens is maybe I like just quit playing poker or something and just go back to school. I'm like a year or two behind, but then I really like took off the second time around, which was in 2007.
How in the world did you hide your drug addiction from your parents and your friends? Well, not friends, but how in the world did you hide it from your parents?
Surprisingly, neither one of my parents, being baby boomers, were big into drugs growing up. My dad swears on his life that he never smoked weed, which I never really believed in the multiple times that I had asked him over the years, but we actually just recently talked about it again, and for like the first time in my life, I believe him. I mean, I don't know why he would just like not just tell me, but yeah, so they were like kind of naive as to, you know, what stuff smelled like. They knew I was smoking cigarettes, so, you know, I guess they just didn't really know the difference in smell between cigarettes and marijuana. And then my drug of choice at the time was cocaine, so it's not like a painkiller where you're going to be like nodding out or like really like sleepy or something and kind of out of it. You're just a little bit more hyper, but if you're smart about it, I guess you can hide it much easier than other drugs.
Yeah, I'm your parents' age, and I think I've tried anything and everything. I used to be a toxic waste garbage disposal system, so I know all about the drugs. And but man, coke, that's a pretty expensive habit right there.
Yeah, it led me to do things that I never would have thought possible. I mean, I had a friend who I sold $220 from. Like, I never thought that I would have ever stolen from someone in my life. And then, like, actually, a year and a half later after that happened, like, I had never told her, but, like, part of the recovery process is just, you know, like, forgiving yourself and asking for forgiveness. So I called her, hadn't seen her, talked to her in a while, and told her, like, what I did, and that I wanted her address so that I could mail her a check for $500. And it's just, like, I'm sorry, and, like, it just wasn't me. I was just completely out of my mind.
Wow. So, you know, being a full-time poker player, you must know that you know, you'll be working under a lot of pressure, and you also need to be 100% alert about the moves of other players at the table. Personally, I want to congratulate you for winning your fight against drugs. I mean, that's a hell of a job. Awesome. Well done. I've been there, and I know what you go through to get sober and clean. And when you went to rehab back in 2007 and then you had your relapse, what in the hell made you decide to go to Vegas, of all places, to get clean?
Well, yeah, I was clean from August 8th, 2007 until sometime in February 2011. I was starting 2011, where I would say I was at least like a 90% favorite to be a millionaire by the end of the year. And then I just like had a few things happen to me personally that were tough to deal with, along with playing the biggest games that I'd ever played. I had 300K losing days in the first 6 weeks of 2011, and I was still winning like 150 or 200 on the year, so I was just playing much, much bigger. I think previously to 2011, my biggest losing day was like 45,000, so it was just a big transition into swinging massive, and you know, it's kind of tough to adjust to it, and that was like adding to the stress as well as not going to meetings or anything. I kind of slipped off my program. So I relapsed in February 2011, and then it was like a long snowballing process. And then I went to Vegas for Five Diamond in December with Christian Harder and Tony Gregg. We were all staying together at Aria, and I lost like 40,000 playing cash out there, being messed up the whole time I was flying, and I was at the end of a 400K downswing for the year, and I just remember Christian walking in the room when I was like breaking up Roxy's on the like desk at Aria, and he just like bitched me out and stuff, and something just hit me. Like, I really just needed someone to just tell me how badly I was messing up, even though I knew I was messing up.
Right.
I was in denial and trying to do both at the same time, because I had the skill set to be an elite player, so I thought that I could just do both, you know, because before, when I was doing drugs, I wasn't nearly as good as I was this time around, so I thought I could get away with it, but that's just the mindset of a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, thinking that you can do things in moderation, but then it just takes over your life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I praise you for locking yourself up for those 3 days and detoxing. I know you went through hell and back, and it's not easy. Is that when you were detoxing, were you detoxing from the coke, or were you detoxing from morphine, or
no,
just a bunch?
The second time around was, I started smoking weed, then I started doing a bunch of Adderall going into the World Series, and I did Adderall every single day during the World Series. Like my first time playing in Bobby's room, playing 200, 500,000, half and half, I'm like on Adderall. It's just like, you know, why would I ever do that? I lost like 90,000 in that game. And then in the fall, like early fall, I got introduced to Roxy Cotton for the first time. I've been offered painkillers for forever. I mean, people just have them. And I always turned them down because I just knew that that could be the end of my life, like literally. I guess I could be just biased here, but I think that the overdose rate is higher for the downers and the painkillers instead of uppers.
Oh, yeah.
It's just so easy to overdo it and just stop breathing, or like your heart just stop beating. So I was always afraid that I wouldn't be able to control myself, and I made a bad decision one night and did maybe like 1/6 of a pill, and then a month later I'm doing 150 milligrams a day, and still playing big games, like live and online, and just losing and losing, and I was also doing coke again too, but not so often because I liked Roxy's a lot more. It was like my ultimate drug choice that I didn't find until I was 23, so I was lucky to not find it until I had much more going for myself than when I was younger and felt like I was worthless.
Well, that's awesome that you're open about your addiction. I know a lot of people look up to you for that more than, you know, getting through it, you know, more than actually winning the bracelet.
Absolutely, I do. I do. Yeah, I do. That's very impressive.
Yeah,
something.
It's definitely, it's a pretty crazy lifestyle to live when you have to deal with something like this every day.
Yeah, and now that you're clean, I mean, everything is just, you're like, wow, you know, this is really cool that I can do this without having drugs, and I bet you probably have a better relationship with your parents and your friends and your girlfriend, because you're not hiding anything anymore. You're not being the substance abuser and trying to deceive people and steal. I mean, you're open and with everything, and it's just such a much better life, you know? You don't have to live in that shithole anymore. Just, it really sucks. I've been there, and so I know what you've gone through, and you know, you're showing the poker world that you can overcome your addictions and become a better player, because look at you now. My God, I mean, what are you, 25?
Yeah, I mean, that's like a lot of the emotion that people saw for me on TV, and even more so when I won the first bracelet, was stemming from everything that I had been through, and I just never gave up on my dreams. Not that, like, winning bracelets were ever in my dreams, because I've always been a cash game player, but I do go to Vegas every summer, and I play all the shorthanded events, and I usually average like six or seven tournaments each summer. So realistically, for me to win one bracelet over my career is good enough. Let alone
but you won two.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, let alone So I it's pretty emotional.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the bracelet. Obviously, I'm sure the emotional was the validation. I mean, a lot of people don't incorporate, you know, the average Joes don't incorporate, you know, playing cash games, you know, necessarily being a great player. I mean, obviously there is a huge skill set at playing cash games, but sometimes people are thinking you're just picking on fish, or, you know, a poker player is picking on, you know, weak players or business, which a lot of it is that, but as a tournament player, there's a validation on your skill set, and which, you know, to the general public, in other words, you know, and as a career choice, and as, you know, what you were hoping to achieve in your life, and to do it and bounce back from all the adversity is a huge statement. I'm sure it was overwhelming. You know, the emotions you're talking about from winning the 10K six-handed event.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the six max win was validation to myself as, or I guess, like, for all the work that I had put in over the years, because six max online cash has been my main focus since the end of 2007, and I've played like probably 7 million hands of six max. And like 500,000 hands of full ring, so most of my hands have been six max. And to win the world championship version of the full ring poker that I love was just really sick validation for me. And then to win the main event was validation for everyone that said that I would never be able to do this for a living, and all the people that just kind of hated on me. Like, I come from a very doctor, lawyer, banker town, 9-to-5, conservative. Like, I guess there's some entrepreneurship, but it's more of a corporate little bubble. So if you don't go to school for 4 years and then go to grad school, I mean, what are you doing with your life? Is kind of the way people look at you. So that was the coolest thing about winning the event.
Yeah, that sucks when people have to be so judgmental like that.
It's already bad enough for our profession that we're just, as a professional gambler, the general society just thinks that we're degenerates who gamble 24/7 on everything, and, like, I mean, it's just not like that at all. I mean, for some people it is, but the best players that win the most money and keep the most money, which is the most important thing, are the ones that are much more business-like with their approach. And
did you go back to town and say
that it's been
did you go back to town and say, how do you like me now? I mean,
no,
I would have done that.
I was back for the night before Thanksgiving. Like, it's a big party night, and everyone goes to the same bar every year, so I was there, and that was pretty wild, because, you know, some of these people only see me once a year anyways, because I haven't lived in that area since 2009, but I was always in town for the holidays, so I would only see a lot of those people once a year, and I mean, last year was a little different situation when they saw me, so it was pretty crazy.
So what was the first thing you did after you won the main event, and what was the first thing you bought?
I had told my friends that we would go to Hawaii if I won, and then if I didn't win, we'd go to Miami. But then after I won, we still just ended up going to Miami. I took two of my best friends. We've been friends since kindergarten, and I, like, paid for all their stuff, and then my girlfriend came, and Christian and Tony came. We were down staying at Fountain Blue, and then the first thing that I bought was two courtside tickets to Miami Heat game. And, like, LeBron was stepped on my girlfriend's toes when he was shooting a fadeaway jumper.
So do you still carry your little black box around with you? I mean, do you still cherish that little guy and take it with you when you travel?
My dad, I gave my dad my first bracelet because I got fifth in the Formax like a day before Father's Day, and I was like, man, I told him, I was like, I really wanted to win so I could give it to you for Father's Day, and then 2 weeks later, I won the 6 Max, so I gave him that one, and I told my mom she would get the next one. So then the next one just so happened to be
the main
bracelet.
Oh, that's
wow.
Very cool.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah,
that's great. Well, I know you're giving us some great support this year up in New York for the All In for Wishes tournament, which is October 9th, to support the Make-A-Wish Foundation. I mean, do you feel like poker is evolving in society where people are slowly changing their minds as to, you know, the potential that poker can give back to society, you know, and especially in tournaments?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the charity poker scene has been pretty booming I guess it goes along with the poker boom itself. Like, since I wasn't a, quote, celebrity poker player, I was never really involved in many charity poker tournaments outside of just small things for friends and stuff in Vegas. But, yeah, I mean, I'm excited to be going there. It's only a two-hour drive from Syracuse, where my girlfriend lives, and I spend quite a bit of time up there, so it doesn't really affect my travel schedule at all, which is really, like, the biggest thing. I've been on the road so much this year that I have to turn down certain opportunities just because I get sick of living out of my suitcase.
Right.
So I bet you had friends coming out of the woodwork that you didn't even know you had. And how has your life changed since you've won?
I mean, actually, there really hasn't been too much of that. Like, not as much as you would think. And then a lot of the times when it is happening, I'm like fortunate to have had the experience slowly over the years, where at 19 years old I was making like good six figures a year, and all my friends were in college, so I was experiencing, you know, that type of behavior from a young age, and then it kind of just progressed as I made more money throughout my career, and it was just like a good, I guess, backbone to have in order to deal with something like winning the main event. And then it also helps to not travel the circuit full time, where you have people hitting you up for like buy-ins to tournaments because the wire isn't there, and they just need to borrow money or whatever. I have about four or five people that I've borrowed from and will let borrow over my career, and that number, if anything, shrinks over time and pretty much never gets bigger.
Good deal. Good man. Good choice.
Yeah, obviously you're coming across, you know, extremely grounded, you know, so it's been a, you know, with the exception of the drugs, which I think has been, you know, something that fortunately happened, you know, while you are young, and now you still got your whole life ahead of you and a solid, you know, solid foundation now. You know what you're capable of doing. You know, the mistakes that you've made, and you've, you know, come through them. And really, I mean, I'm sure you've got, you know, high expectations for yourself in the next 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, poker is honestly what saved my life. I mean, it might sound silly to people to hear that come out of someone's mouth, but it was my passion at the time, and you know, it still is. Like, I was a straight-A student from sixth grade until I graduated high school with 4.0 GPA, and then I go to college and I'm just failing with a 1.1 GPA, and I had never experienced any type of failure academically, and like, I was an athlete in high school as well, and then that stopped in college. So when I found poker, it was just like a nice
outlet.
For me to just channel my energy into something different. Like, I was tired of school. I felt like I had just, when I went to college, they were asking me to do all the same stuff that I just did in high school, and I wanted to study business, but I had to wait another 2 years to apply for the business school, and I just didn't feel like doing school anymore, and poker was just so much more challenging and intricate for me. And I, like, long story short, if I didn't have something that I was so passionate about, the rest of my life was falling into a deep depression and not feeling like I was worthy of anything good anymore. And it was just, it was getting really bad, so.
Yeah, the same way. Same way that, you know, getting kids involved in athletics or, you know, some of the strong extracurricular activities keeps them out of, you know, getting involved with a lot of the bad habits. Not that there's bad things that don't happen inside of athletics, but you have to have a passion. I definitely understand that.
Well, that's pretty cool that you say poker saved your life, because I don't think I think you're the only person I've ever heard say that. You know, poker saved my life. People would probably think you're crazy if they didn't know why, you know? I mean, they'd probably say, this guy's just off his friggin' rocker, you know?
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's been, I couldn't think of anything better to just channel my addiction, you know? It's just, I mean, it is, playing online poker is extremely addicting to me, and over the last, like, 18 months, I've been able to channel it much better than in previous years, where the second time around getting clean, I didn't care about how much money I had. I didn't care about how much money I was making. I totally just surrendered to the fact that I got to do what I loved every day, and it didn't matter if it took me five more years to become a millionaire, 2 years to become a millionaire. Like, I didn't care about the financial status anymore. And I never wanted the money for, like, expensive things. It was just like an addiction to money, and I mean, a lot of people have that, but it's like funny how it works, because as I started developing that mindset about 6 to 7 months before the World Series last year, then obviously, like, it all comes my way, and then it's just crazy how it works like that, because, I mean, it really helps you play too, you know, just not caring so much about winning or losing and just playing good, and
right,
the rest takes care of itself.
But it's just sick to think that, I mean, did you ever think when you were 16 getting started out in poker that before you were 25 you were going to be a freaking millionaire? I mean,
that's just cool.
I bet that feeling, yeah. I bet that feeling is just better than any high, you know?
Yeah, it is, and now it's fun to have, you know, all these options of getting into other areas of business. But I mean, I don't see my main focus shifting outside of poker really ever, unless I like fall in love with something else. But I mean, I started a real estate company, but it's not like I would quit poker to become full time. Realtor, or to manage this company, I would just end up hiring someone if we got that big.
Any chance of going back to school and getting a degree just to say I can do it because I was a straight A student?
Not right now, at least. I don't really have any interest in being told what to study, when, where to be, like, I don't know.
You just don't want that structure.
Yeah,
you want
to... I was going back this second time around to do like a drug counseling program. So that's something that if I ever did go back, that's what it would be.
That's cool.
That's like the only really interest I have being, I guess, like a real person and working a 9-to-5 would be helping other people the way my counselor really helps me turn my life around.
That's awesome. So if they were to make a movie about your life, who would you want to see play the lead role and why?
I'll say Shia LaBeouf, but I don't really know why. I just like him as an actor, and he's somewhat, I guess he's about the same age as me. He might be a little older.
That's cool.
Well, on our... for our listeners, I mean, as far as, you know, now tapping into your pro intellect, you know, going into online play or playing tournaments, what would be, you know, an area of gameplay that you would say amateurs should work on the most to take their game to the next level?
I mean, this question can go off in several different tangents, but I guess the biggest thing is game selection and not being, don't be ashamed of playing smaller games because you're a winner in that game. Like, you don't have to, say you were a 5'10 pro or say you're a 2'5 semi pro, like good amateur, and you've been doing that for the last 5 years, but over the last year of those 5 years, you've just been getting crushed, and you're not being honest with yourself that you're probably not a winner in the game anymore. Well, there's nothing wrong with moving down to 1-3 and just making money and enjoying poker again at a much more relaxed environment where you're playing for less money, you're playing against weaker opponents. You can really just regain your confidence before moving back up. And the same can be said about tournaments as well. I mean, a lot of people, it's like an ego thing. A lot of people don't want to move down and they're not honest with their skill set.
Right. What's the biggest leak outside of playing too many hands that most amateurs, you know, possess?
I think, like, when you flop a really good hand and possibly even the nuts with, like, a redraw to a flush or something, and then the board texture dramatically changes on the turn and then even more so on the river, just being so attached to your hand on the flop, and then, like, making a bad call on the river where they're like, oh, I flopped enough, I'm never losing that hand. And now on the river, based on the action, their hand is never good, but they always call. Or not always, but they call too often in a spot where a pro is just going to be like, that sucks, and then just fold. So
yeah.
I think that's the biggest thing.
Can't really get away from things. Like when you're sitting at the table, obviously at higher levels than most of us play, all of us play, but I mean, when you're sitting at the table, what are you looking for specifically, you know, as a spot to pick up chips from another, either in a tournament or, you know, obviously for you predominantly in a cash game, but most of our listeners are tournament players online, and you know, so what do you look for as a unique spot? Obviously, you know, the button's a good place to pick up chips at times, but you know, what are you looking for as a sign of weakness or somebody that you can pick chips up from?
I'd say a pretty good spot is when, well, for all levels of play, or when an amateur player limps in a cash game or a tournament, and then a pro who knows what they're doing or an amateur who knows what he's doing isolates them. It's a good spot to 3-bet, whether you're in position or out of position behind him. Because your 3-bet is now winning more chips than just 3-betting an open itself. And if you have a good image, it's going to work quite often. Sometimes you'll run into a good hand, obviously, but that's a spot to look for. A more advanced spot is if you don't have too high of a 3-bet percentage for online cash and you have a pretty good image, I look for cold 4-bet spots because it looks so strong and, you know, once again, there's more money in the pot. So, like, if you have a good image, you always want to use it when there's more money in the pot than when it's just, like, a button raise and you decide to 3-bet the small blind with 9-6 seated.
Right.
Like, I could use that, my image, to cold 4-bet ace-8 seated from the big blind when the button opens and the small blind 3-bets. So, I guess that's more of an advanced one.
If you could sit down and play a game of poker with any 5 people in the world, living or deceased, who would you like to sit down and play with?
Any 5 people?
Any 5 people.
Wilfred Herring.
I'll do Ken Griffey Jr. first.
They're all going to be millionaires. Don't know how to play.
But we'll put Michael Jordan in there because he'll be the fish. And then, I'm probably going to go all sports athletes here. We'll just stick with the D-Gens. We'll put Charles Barkley in there. I'm trying to play big, and I'm trying to win a lot of money, so I've got to think about some more. I got Griffey there just so I can, like, he's my favorite athlete of all time. I played poker with Joey Porter once, and he was awesome, so I'll throw him in there. He's used to be linebacker for the Steelers.
Maybe an owner.
And Guy's actually gotten a lot better at poker. I don't know, one of the Macau guys that I played with. I don't know their names. You can put one of them in there too.
So that was one of our other questions. Obviously it sounds like if you had a choice of playing against bad amateurs or good pros where you knew where you were at, obviously you'd rather play against the bad players as long as they've got money.
If it's short-handed, it's fine to play with all fish because the spots are easier for me to read just because that's my main format, and also you have less like randomness going on without having those other three players at the table. There's so many weird things that people can do nine-handed if there's a lot of fish in the game where you don't really know what the hell's going on. I don't mind, I love playing against elite players. I mean, when I play online, 10-20, 25-50, I mean, 90% of the time there's not a single fish in the game. It's just all pros, and certain pros think they're better than others and whatnot, so it's just complete battling for, you know, whoever thinks they're the best, and it's just really good practice, and I love it.
So do you like online opposed to live play? Which
yeah,
is your
I like
favorite?
It a lot better, just because in the prime of my online career, I was playing 1,800 hands an hour.
Oh my God.
Nowadays, I play about 1,000 to 1,100 hands an hour. And then it's just a huge adjustment going to live poker. And live poker is predominantly four-ring. And I like to play heads up to six-handed. So it's a totally different game. With nine-handed, I had to kind of relearn poker when I started playing high stakes live because people just have good hands way more often than they do shorthanded. So there's less complicated spots and the ranges are more defined to certain hands because, you know, it's nine handed, you can just kind of wait for good hands if you want to.
So that's what, 28 tables at once? Roughly?
Well, I used to, 24 tabled for 3 years, but now, I mean, I've gotten up to 24 once or twice this year, but normally I try not to go over 16, and if I'm playing all 10, 20, and 25, 50, I usually won't go over 16.
Oh my gosh.
And even that, it's just kind of ridiculous because of how good everyone is, but I like the challenge.
When you're multi-tabling like that online, are you playing just a specific handset, or are you actually getting more involved with knowing the players because it's a lot of the same players at all the same tables? Or
yeah, it depends. It depends on the lineup because I mean for 25-50 on Stars, there's probably 30 guys that play, probably not even 30 actually, that play regularly, and. Obviously, when we play against the same people quite often, you have to mix it up. So a lot of it is going to depend on who's playing, what seats I have on which tables, and then who's winning or losing during the session, and how I think the game flow is, whether I should open it up or just play tighter and take advantage of how aggressive everyone else is playing and just try to blend in as being aggressive but really just play kind of tight.
Do you use any tools to keep up with players' ranges and all that, or is it just you knowing where they're at?
I use Poker Tracker 4, but I I didn't use Poker Tracker from 2009 until after Black Friday, which is when I played, like, for 2 full years that I got Supernova lead on Stars, which is, I probably played 3 to 3.5 million hands. I didn't use any tracking software at all. I became so in tune with playing with the same guys every day, and then all I would really have to focus on is the fish. And I just, the software would kind of slow down my tables and not let it run as smooth, so it would piss me off and I would just turn it off. Just 24 tables with software running on top of it, it doesn't run as smooth as it does without it.
Good God, you're insane, man. How many monitors did you have to have up?
Well, I started with 6 tables tiled, then I moved to 9 tiled, and then 12, 16, 20, 24. When I got to 18, I started cascading them, and then all the way up to 24. This is, like, all on a laptop or a single 30-inch monitor.
All on a laptop? Are you sick?
I'm sorry?
I said, all on a laptop? Are you sick or insane? Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, it's not as crazy as it seems. So then, like, 24 tabling now, what I was getting to is that I switched to cascading because my wrists were starting to bother me, and then even with cascading, my wrists were still bothering me because I was playing so much, so I eventually just maximized the table and then stacked every table on top of each other so that the tables just pop up.
Kind of like Rush Poker?
I'm sorry?
It's kind of like Rush Poker, where the hands just...
Yeah, exactly.
As soon as you lose a hand, you got another... Yeah.
Yeah, so they're just all stacked on top of each other, and they come up in the order of importance based on, like, your turn. And if I have, like, a really important decision or I'm in a really big hand, I'll drag it off to the side a little bit so I can see what's going on, and then when the hand's over, I just slide it back in the stack.
Cool.
Do you have any superstitions in poker at all? Like, you have to have this sitting at your table at a certain angle, or you have a certain lucky thing that you stick by your computer monitor, or any kind of superstitions at all?
I don't think so. Not for online poker, at least. I guess for live, I have, like, the jersey thing, where for whatever reason, I started wearing jerseys when I played live tournaments a few years ago, and I just kind of kept doing it, and now I guess I'll be doing it until I feel like wearing something else. I don't know.
So do you agree that sunglasses is to poker as steroids are to baseball?
Sunglasses?
Uh-huh.
I think that Adderall is the substitution for for sunglasses.
You played baseball,
didn't
you?
Yeah, I did. But I never reached a level in baseball where I was around people that were juicing or anything. But my brother played college baseball, and he had teammates that did it. And, yeah, I mean, I think that sunglasses are just silly not to wear. I mean, unless they bother you, you're just giving away a certain amount of information every once in a while, at least. I don't care, like, how good you are.
Well, we've got to get you in some Blue Shark optics. We've got to get you into some Blue Shark optics.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I just have these prescription sunglasses that I got from, like, Costco or something, and they just these are the ones that I wear.
Well, we'll definitely get you next time we're at a location where the booth's set up. We'll definitely get you over there and try some out.
Yeah.
Well, you know that, I mean, everybody knows the November 9 set for this year. I mean, what was going on in your head, you know, between the time it was set and the time it, you know, to play? I mean, what's going through their head right now?
It's pretty cool to wake up every day at the final table of the main event. I mean, it's, you know, even if you have a bad day, whether it's poker-related or personally, it's like, well, I get to play for $8 million, and, you know, now I guess there's 7 weeks, 6 or 7 weeks away. It's pretty ridiculous experience that they're going to go through. you know, whoever gets knocked out first is the worst feeling ever, I'm sure, and you have up to 100 tickets that you're allowed to give out, so you have people coming from all over the country, all over the world to watch you play, and then if you get knocked out in the first half an hour, I mean, no one wants to do that.
Right.
And then, obviously, there's people that take bad beats, that's sick, too, and, yeah, I mean...
Do you like the delay? I mean, would you have rather gotten it over, like, a day later, or did you like the... You know, the delay till you only had to go through till October because of the election, but
I think the only downside of it for good players is that you have these other less experienced players receiving coaching,
right,
and whatnot. But still, like, I didn't get any coaching. I just kind of talked over a little bit of strategy with Anthony Gregg and Christian Harder, and then I just watched all the episodes, but they don't really show much other than like a few hands. So the funny thing is I kind of had reads on what I thought my opponents were gonna have as their game plan coming in based on who their coach was, because a lot of their coaches were like top level players that I've played against for years.
Right.
So I understand, like, what they're going to be preaching. And so I was able to kind of, like, use that to my advantage. I think another thing with the 15-minute delay for the final table and being able to access the hands on 15-minute delay from your rail, like, greatly, like, it gives the online players a much bigger edge who are used to just being able to click on hand histories for information, see what someone's hand was at showdown, where live players never get to see the hand because it's bad etiquette. So, like, I am trained, as well as other online players are trained, to read hand ranges based on showdowns that we've seen for thousands or millions of hands, and then like set up a dynamic based on knowing what our opponents are doing. And like, I set up a really nice spot against Jesse Sylvia from using that information, where I got him to bluff raise like 8 million on the flop, because I had been leading with weak hands and I knew the information was getting back to him, so I was going to wait for a good hand to lead with next, and then he went for it and I was like a step ahead of him.
Awesome. I bet Christian had to feel a little validation too for, you know, helping you kind of make a turn in your life, and you know, when you won the bracelet.
Yeah, he's a really good kid. I mean, I have a lot of good friends, but he was the most like straight edge kid of all of them. Like, all he does is drink, and he's so anti drugs that it's a really good influence to have in your life.
Absolutely. You know, addiction is an addiction, and poker is addicting, so I just, you know, it sounds like you're armed with the proper tools to do what you need to do to keep your life on the right track and keep kicking ass and taking names. That's pretty awesome. If you were president for a day, what would you do and why?
Legalize online poker. And fix the tax situation. The taxes keep going up, and it sucks.
Yeah, it does. There's been some recent news about the with Daniel Negreanu blowing up about the first card off. What's your opinion on that rule?
Yeah, I actually tweeted at him about that, how I was happy with how he dealt with it, because someone like himself, who's constantly in the public eye and he's representing the biggest company in our industry, typically has to deal with things like this in a very professional manner, and he just, you know, acted like a normal human being would and didn't care what anyone was going to think. I mean, I'm sure he overreacted somewhat, but, you know, if he handles it in a professional way, it doesn't get as many eyeballs on the situation, which is what needs to happen. And I haven't had it happen to me, but I know what he's talking about. Like, people came over for pictures and autographs during the main event this year, and if I were to have missed a hand because of it when I'm standing right there, I mean, I would have got pissed off, and I think it's kind of a silly rule, so hopefully it'll get fixed, and I'm sure, I mean, anything that he's behind usually gets done, so we'll see.
Yeah, I think it's... Certainly there's a reason they do it, but I mean, I think it is a little extreme. I mean, we try to play in our local little group here, where we play a series and then we send a player every year out to the main event. I mean, we try to play by the World Series rules, but that's even one that we couldn't do. I mean, we kind of like, if you're in the room, we're considering you at the table, unless the way we do it is unless there's some action, you know, because it's not, I don't think it's fair for somebody to raise when you're not, you know, relatively near the table, assuming that you're not going to be back for the hand, and then all of a sudden you show up and you pick up your cards and you play. But that's kind of the way we do it. But yeah, it seems a little bit extreme. I just wanted to get your input, because it's certainly something that, at least in truly, like you said, it may be something that where Daniel doesn't necessarily handle it that way normally, but you're right, we wouldn't be talking about it if he didn't, and probably wouldn't even be aware of it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really affect me that much, since I'm not playing like 60 tournaments, 80 tournaments a year like these guys are. I mean, it would really upset me if I had to do that. Although I saw a picture of him carrying around his chair whenever he would walk away from the table, that way they couldn't say that he wasn't in his seat.
On his chair. Arm's length, yeah. What would you say, you know, cash games, I guess, especially, would be the most annoying habit, you know, a player does have at the table? What annoys you the most at the table?
There's certain people that just never shut up, so I have to wear headphones, but I don't really mind people talking. It's like, I'd rather have a table full of people talking than no one saying anything. Especially if it's not a high-stakes game. It's just kind of boring sitting around not being able to interact. That's why, that's why the amateurs that play high-stakes don't particularly enjoy going to casinos, because they're going to play against tight pros who don't interact socially and don't understand how to accommodate a fish the way the pros that get to play private games do. I guess just people that talk too much, or I guess that's it. Nothing really bothers me that much, though.
What genre of music do you have loaded up on your iPod?
It's all house music.
House music?
So like electronic house music, like DJs.
DJ dance, kind of keep you
yeah,
blood pumping.
Yeah, it's I made the transition 2.5 years ago, and I think it's just the most positive, upbeat music that you can listen to, and it just, like, gets me motivated and happy, and I don't know, I like it a lot.
Cool. Well, I know you're a big advocate of the PPA. I think I read where you even turned down taking $10,000 to wear the patch, and you wore it for free. I mean, when do you think, you know, the legalization of online poker? I know we're kind of getting into the state-by-state stuff right now, but I mean, when do you think it's going to be, you know, nationally accepted as okay? I mean, I myself think it's a little hypocritical. We got lotteries and everything else, but can't have a skill game to spend our money on. But
Yeah. I mean, my girlfriend can tell you how mad I get whenever I see, like, Mega Million lottery jackpots in the 300 million range. It's just like so frustrating. But I always answered this question by saying 2015 you'd be nationwide, but I think I'm pushing that back to like late 2015, maybe even 2016. The stuff just moves so slow, and it's pretty embarrassing.
It is. I saw one of your recent tweets that you were going back to Canada to the true land of the free. I mean, it is crazy that all the other countries get to play. And I mean, you look at the lotteries, and I'm in Georgia, and obviously it's just lottery here. And I mean, the rake of what they, you know, the reality of the rake of what they pull out of the funds collected is like right around 45%, I think, you know, which is insane.
Yeah, and then they tax the winner like 40% or 50%.
Exactly. Yeah, it's insane. I mean, poker is, I mean, I mean, you know, it's just the reason you have passion for it, because it's competitive. It's something that you can obviously work at and get better at and make more money at, and it definitely has a skill capacity. And everything that prohibits it here in Georgia, the law about gambling is if it uses balls, dice, or cards, it's considered gambling, and that's exactly what the lottery is. I mean, it's just balls that have numbers on them getting pulled out. No skill
at
all.
Yeah, I know. It really is just like such an outdated thinking process or thought process. And I think the thing that frustrates me the most is that I can't live in my country and, you know, do what I want to do for my main source of income, but I'm still expected to pay income tax on all of that money that I make. So it's like, yeah, you can't do this here, but you still got to pay us 42% a year, and it's just, like, so ridiculous.
Absolutely. It's politics.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
What is in all your travels, and I mean, what do you think the poker rooms can do to attract more players? You know, in general, you know, poker players. I mean, do you do a lot of other games besides poker, or are you pretty strictly poker?
No, I only play poker. Are you asking me if I play like casino games or anything?
Yeah, I mean, you know, casinos kind of predominantly, you know, are built on all the other games, not poker, and, you know, so they've kind of over the, you know, in the past, you know, poker players don't earn comps as quick as other players do, at least at the same levels as a lot of the people playing some of the table games, you know, the low limit players, the 1-2s, the 2-5s, you know, poker players are kind of the low end of the spectrum. You know, what's something that casinos can do to attract more players? And
yeah, I mean, that's gonna come down to casino owners, like seeing the big picture of like what poker rooms can do for a casino and how treating them the best way possible just drives business and gets repeat customers in the door, which then obviously, it gets people in the pit as well. I mean, there's some correlation between poker players playing in your room and then playing in the pit later, or, you know, if they're stuck, they go play in the pit or something. So there is some benefit to it. And I think the best rooms that you see in the U.S. are the ones that offer their players the best accommodations. I mean, I'm not really sure who's in charge, who has the final say. And in these poker rooms, as to, you know, what the comp rates are, or, you know, who gets free rooms, who gets poker rate rooms. It's like this. Take Borgata, for example. I mean, everyone that I know that plays there, as well as myself when I used to play there a bunch, I got free rooms every weekend. And if you don't have any rate for a room there, it's like $400 a night. So.
Right.
I mean, I don't blame them for being, like, casinos for being stingy by giving out free rooms, but a place like that that's sold out almost every weekend, giving out free rooms to poker players, I mean, that's taking care of your clients, and then for that reason, you have a really dominant room on the East Coast. I mean, it is the best room on the East Coast right now.
Is that your favorite place to play, or in the world, or
Macau? I think the Bellagio is my favorite place just because of the prestige of Bobby's room and all the like Hall of Fame players that have played there, and it just has a lot of history to it. But yeah, Borgata, I would say Borgata is probably my second favorite place to play, just because I know a lot of the staff there and I was always treated really nice there. It's like a really unique experience playing there. You have a lot of shit talking between the regulars and a lot of needling, where out on the West Coast or in Europe, Australia, Macau, it's unlike any other atmosphere. It just has something to do with being from the Northeast, where people like to talk shit to each other, but not in like a really mean way, just to like have fun with each other.
Right.
Do you tip according to pot size or consistent each time?
No, I tip it according to pot size, but I've never tipped more than $100 on a single hand. I mean, I've tipped out $400 or $500 at the end of the night at private games. But I've always been like pretty consistent based on the pot with it never going over $100. But I would say that I am one of the biggest tippers of anyone I know. I'm usually the biggest tipper at the table when I'm playing, unless there's some like rich amateur just tipping like an outrageous amount. I mean, I have to like not tip too much, you know?
Yeah.
So like when a lot of pros would just tip a dollar, I'm usually tipping like $2 or $3. And I mean, that adds up for the dealers. I dealt for like 4 months at an underground game when I was 17, and like I got some experience of what it was like to work on tips, even though it wasn't that long. I mean, I worked like 15, 16 hours sometimes, and it's definitely appreciative when people tipped extra than more than a dollar.
Now, do you have a secret talent that nobody would expect you to have, something that you're just naturally good at that the average person wouldn't know? Maybe something that you enjoy that no one would know. I mean, what do you do when you're not playing poker?
I used to be pretty damn good at Tetris.
Ah, gamer.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's like another reason poker worked out so well for me, is because it was a mix of competition from my sporting background and gaming background. I never played computer games, but I was a big video game player, and the mix was just like, all right, now I can play a video game for money that involves competition, and I don't really play video games anymore, but I try to. They're just, everyone's so good at them that I can't enjoy it, getting crushed all the time.
Yeah.
I hate video games. Ugh. I think the only game I think I've ever played was Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, and that was a long, long,
my
long
God.
Time ago.
Yeah, I had that game.
What's up next for you besides the All In For Wishes? What's where are you heading to?
I'm in Toronto right now playing WCUPE. I just got here on Saturday. WCUPE just started yesterday.
And people need to get on your follow your Twitters, because you're giving out some free percentages, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I don't think people do this enough, especially the really elite faces of poker that get sponsorship money. I mean, whatever. This is just an idea that I had. And did for World Series Australia, and it went over really well. So I decided I would just do it again for every single event that I played during the WCUPE, giveaway between 1% and 5% based on some random question that I ask, and either the best answer or the correct answer, depending on the question, is going to be awarded. I always announce like which event and how much percent is being pre-rolled. I just did one today for 3% of the 1K tomorrow. And first place is usually like in the 300,000s, maybe 400,000. So,
pick me.
Well, someone already won, but I could win someone like $10,000 tomorrow, so that would be cool.
That's pretty damn awesome.
Very unlikely. We'll see.
That's awesome. Very cool. Very cool of you.
Well, do you have any aspirations to? I mean, are you teaching anybody now? Do you do any coaching or, you know, books or anything on your story?
No, I don't. I want to have more life experience and way more clean time before I write a book about, you know, all this stuff. And if I do write a book, then I don't want to make any money off of it. I would just want to donate everything, all the profits, and just like break even on it, because I'm not trying to make money off of my story or anything. So I'm sure that there'll be a time when I do that. I used to teach for 400 for a 90-minute session in 2009, 2010, and then I just got frustrated with certain clients that, you know, I'd wake up early one day, they wouldn't be there when I got to my computer, or I don't know, it's tough to teach, you know, to really just give someone what they need in an hour and a half in such a complex game, and you don't understand how they learn, whether it's through game theory or playing or watching you play. Like, there's just so many different ways to help someone get better, and I don't want to just, like, rob someone, you know?
Right.
Because I would want to find out what's the best way for them to get better before I would charge them, and then that becomes so time-consuming.
You want to charge them, but you want them to feel the value as well. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not going to... Because I know what my hourly is roughly for online poker, and I don't want to go charging people that much money to coach them how to play poker. And anyone that would really need it is going to be someone that is either a competitor of mine or slightly below me that could be playing against me shortly, and it wouldn't be smart to coach them.
Not correctly, anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I actually had a guy sign up on 2 plus 2. He had a different name on 2 plus 2 than he did on Stars, and then when I logged on to TeamViewer and Skype to coach him, it was a guy that played in the same games as me. And that's when I started realizing, like, I don't really know if I want to do this anymore.
Takes up a lot of time, and sometimes it's like a wasted energy. You know, you could be spending that energy on playing poker and doing something else besides teaching somebody that doesn't have the balls to show up when you're giving your time. And I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, because some of these guys I was doing from Europe, from Australia, just different time zones, so I was trying to accommodate them, and then I don't like waking up to alarms at all. So the first time that happened, I was like, all right, this is never happening again.
Yeah, and I mean...
I also would typically feel bad about how much I was charging and go over time with the client. I would almost always spend 2 hours each session.
Do you have a professional poker player that before you won the main event that you kind of looked up to, and is there one that you kind of feels overrated right now?
The one that I look up to is definitely Tony Gregg, and always has been. He's really sick, and it's nice for him to get the recognition he's been receiving over the last year or so, because he's just always been that sick, and he just always went about his business so quietly and made millions of dollars before the like general public even knew who he was. He's always been the one I look up to, and still is. He'll be in town Thursday. We live together and travel together, so that's nice to have someone that good around quite a bit. Help me out, Grant. Who do you think's the most overrated poker player right now? Yeah, it's gotta be Quick. All right.
He didn't say Greg Merson, did he?
Nah, he didn't say me. Nah, I want to give you a good answer on this. I usually don't answer this question, but I want to answer this. We'll do a duo of Elky and Eugene Kachlov, because they travel the world playing every single tournament, and I don't remember the last time they did anything. So they have to just be down like millions over the last couple of years, because they play everything. And I believe Eugene is actually an exceptional poker player. So it's tough to put him out there like that, but I mean, he's been going everywhere for a long time.
Cool. Well, that's about all I got. Pam, you got any final thoughts? Or
no, I'm just totally impressed, Greg, with how young you are and what you've overcome. I mean, you've had some major obstacles in your life that you've had to overcome, and man, if you were standing right here in front of me, I'd give you a hug, not a handshake, because what you've accomplished, not only in poker but with your addiction, is huge. And I wish you much luck and success continuing on being sober and clean. And if you could just do me one favor, I mean, you've already done tons of people a favor by coming on air and talking openly about your addiction, and I pray to God that you've helped one person out there that's tuned in. But if you could do one thing for me that I ask every interview that I do, if you could say, "Hi, this is Greg Merson, and you're listening to On Tilt Radio."
Yeah, for sure. You want it now?
Yep, anytime.
All right. Hey guys, this is Greg Merson, and you're listening to On Tilt Radio.
Thank you much.
Perfect. We had one question come from our chat room from Rudy Schultz, who's also on the Blue Shark Optics team, one of our newest members. He asked if, as a person pursuing a career as a professional poker player, should they pursue it like all in or continue their day job?
It depends on a lot of different things. It depends on how old they are, what responsibilities they have, whether they're married or have kids. It was a lot easier for someone like myself and a lot of people that I came up with to take a shot when we're 18, 19 years old with really nothing at risk, but losing a year of school or even 2 years. It's really dependent upon the individual's situation, and if they do have responsibilities, a wife, a kid, if they have some type of financial stability from a good paying job that they've done a good job saving money and they want to take a shot, that's fine too. Just be realistic about how much money you need to do it and the amount that you need to set aside for living expenses.
I mean, in the span of that, I mean, do you think that gives, you know, young players, you know, the 18 to 24 now, we'll call them young, and since you're 25, I mean, do you think that gives them a big advantage, you know, just not having all the tangibles hanging on them?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've seen most overrated is Tom DeLonge. A lot of people know that he's one of the weaker high-stakes regs, but the only reason he's ever made a lot of money is from being in the right games at the right time, like the Gee games back Rail Heaven days, and he gets to play really big private games, so I'll lift him. All right, what question were we on? Sorry, I wanted to get that out there.
No, that was it. That was... Just if it gives a huge advantage to young players, you know, obviously there was, you know, the math side of the game has become, you know, pretty dominant in young players, you know, playing online and learning, like you said, the hand ranges and making a lot quicker decisions, a lot faster, just having to make the transition from online to live games, but, you know, having that huge mental edge over, you know,
Being young and hungry is super important, and I've also seen
and fearless.
Guys
I mean,
in I've seen guys in live poker that are younger, like similar age to me, or in their late 20s, early 30s. That when they make the transition to being married or having a kid, it really affects them on the table. They're not able to go for it in spots where they used to because, you know, they're kind of holding back. So, I mean, sometimes life just happens and you have a kid when you weren't planning on it or years before you planned on it. So, I mean, I can only imagine what they're going through playing with, you know, money that's going to pay for a lot of things that are not
I mean, I'm 50, and I mean, I wish this was 30 years ago, because I mean, you know, I've got four kids, a wife. I mean, it's just, you know, everything's a decision. You play within your bankroll, but your bankroll is still, you know, your tool, and if you lose it, then, you know, you're starting all over. So I mean, it always plays a factor.
Yeah, a lot of these kids are able to really just go for it too, because if you're talented enough, you can always get staked by someone. So if you go broke, if you have $200,000-$300,000 and you go broke, I mean, who cares? Because you can just get staked and make all that money back. And then these guys that aren't American, that don't pay taxes on their poker income, the German high roller players and the Swedish kids that play super high stakes, I mean, they can go gamble and have a losing year of $2 million because they don't pay taxes. And, you know, if they made $4 million, well, I don't want to name this person, but I know a U.S. player who had made like $2.5 million over 3 years, paid about $1 million in taxes over that time, then he lost $1 million, like the fourth year playing POL, and then after like living expenses and stuff, had now like shrunk his net worth to like a couple hundred thousand, which obviously is good money for someone who's 24, but I mean, far stretch from millions that they've made and have paid the U.S. government $1 million in taxes, and then doesn't get a rebate on any of that when they lose the money back a year later. Like, these right. other kids can really just go for it because they don't have that. Like, we can't have a losing year. It's like extremely detrimental to have a losing year, especially if you want to get a mortgage or, like in my instance, a real estate company where I have 3 mortgages currently and should have my 4th by the end of this month. I can't show a losing year on paper, so I can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's like sitting at a table where you can't beat stuff. The rate.
Yeah.
So. Well, Greg, I definitely appreciate you've given us way more time than we planned on, and definitely appreciate it, and looking forward to meeting you personally in October up in New York, and it's going to be a fantastic event. This is the 4th year I've been involved with them. I'll be bringing up some of my Lucky Leahy tables and the RFID table, and hopefully we'll get you on the final table there and get that live feed going, but definitely looking forward to meeting you, and appreciate your time, and the best of luck to you. And, you know, we're always here for you. You've now got another addition to your family. The Untilt Radio family is it's a small little great community, but we're all family, and we all give you know, support to each other. So definitely appreciate you giving us a bit of your time.
Yeah, no problem, guys.
All right, brother.
Absolutely.
Well, good luck at the tables, and we'll talk to you in about a month.
Definitely. Good luck, and, right. And thanks again, Greg.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks a lot, and awesome conversation. I just looked at my phone. I'm going to have a phone bill for $160 for this call, but it was worth it.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, send it to us. We'll get it taken care of.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
Thank you, Greg, and we'll talk to you in a month.
All right, thanks, guys.
Good luck.
Take care.
All right, bye.